Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the unpleasant history of Forsyth County. Continuing my conversation today with Patrick Phillips about his book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. In the first part of the conversation, we talked about how in 1912 in Forsyth County, after a white girl had been raped and three African-American men, boys really, had been accused of it and hung, how the entire population of 1,100 African-Americans were forced out of Forsyth County by Knight Riders, the Klan, dynamite, gunshots, so on and so forth. And what happened in that time period and what happened to those people. Today, we're continuing the conversation and we'll pick up from here. Patrick, so I want to get to your personal story. You grew up in this county. You talked about how growing up there was all of this kind of racial venom spewed in the in the school bus. And then in 1987, some folks, including your parents, tried to do something. Tell me about that.
Yeah, in 1987, a guy named Chuck Blackburn, who had recently moved to Forsyth, I think from San Francisco, became really, he was surprised and shocked when he realized that his black friends from Atlanta would not come and visit him, you know, across the Forsyth County line. And so he decided to hold a march to protest the ongoing segregation of the county. I think he was appalled to realize that there was still a segregated place, you know, 30 miles north of King's birthplace as late as 1987. And he came up with a fairly modest plan, which was to have a 2-mile march on January 17th, 1987. And it was timed to coincide with the second ever Martin Luther King holiday. And it's easy to forget that was still a controversial thing in 1987. So he wanted to support the King holiday and just, he called it a brotherhood march. And about 75 marchers, mostly African-American civil rights activists from the King Center in Atlanta, but a handful of white locals, including my family, showed up on Bethelview Road and started this march, which no one expected to garner that much attention. But to my parents' surprise, there was a real mob assembled in a pasture along the road, and they very quickly surrounded the marchers, pelted them with rocks, bottles, bricks, you know, chanting racist slurs at everyone, screaming and yelling. And eventually the Georgia Bureau of Investigations and the local police started arresting men for making terrorist threats and for some of the violence. And when they were frisking them, a lot of these guys were armed. So the sheriff let the marchers know. The marcher leading the King Center group was Hosea Williams, who had been one of Martin Luther King's real street generals during the civil rights days, who led the Selma March in 1965. And so the marchers had to give up and they got back on the bus. And at that moment, my parents and my sister were among the very few local people. So as the buses headed down 400 back to Atlanta, there they stood, you know, they could see their car back up the road. And between them and the car was this, you know, kind of drunken, furious band of local whites. And they eventually were put in a police cruiser and, you know, driven back to their car, and they drove home. At that same moment, I was 16, and I think fairly typical of a teenager, I was late to the march and late to meet my parents. And as a result, I went to the town square, and I went there expecting to meet the marchers and expecting to hear Hosea speak. And I got out of my truck and I was walking towards the steps of the county courthouse. And there were all these other young guys with me walking along. And all of a sudden, I heard a PA click on, and a guy just screamed out, you know, raise your hand if you love white power. And all around me, people raised their hands and started chanting white power. And it was at that moment that I realized I thought I was at a peace march, and I had stumbled my way into the absolute heart of the Klan's victory celebration. And in the wake of those events of that day, Forsyth suddenly got attention really all over the country.
Well, the images, describe the images, describe the photographs, what went on TV.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the part of the story that's most familiar to people. That these images went all over the country. People like Coretta Scott King and Gary Hart was running for president, and he came to Forsyth. And a lot of leaders were really shocked and appalled by this. And I think all over the country and really all over the world, people couldn't believe that this kind of racial hatred was still burning in 1987, that led to a march of 20,000 people came back the next week. And I remember, you know, helicopters flying overhead and, you know, 2,000 National Guard troops came out the second time. And it was this, you know, Coretta Scott King called it a great gathering of the family, of the civil rights movement. So it created a huge amount of attention. Oprah Winfrey came to town, recorded an episode on the town square. And, you know, that moment really, on the one hand, it was the beginning of change. On the other hand, it's not like after seeing those images of Klansmen, of people, there was a guy on the square carrying a noose, you know, which I saw when I was there at age 16. After seeing those images, it's not like people of color in Atlanta were all dying to suddenly move up to Forsyth County. So the place didn't really start to change until, you know, the early to mid 90s.
You know, your family marched in that first parade. Did that change how you got along with people at school?
You know, I was going to high school in Gainesville. I had already switched to high school in Gainesville, so I didn't. I was spared that kind of confrontation. But we had a lot of friends, you know, from very old families in the county. A lot of our neighbors. We lived outside of town, and a lot of our neighbors there were from some of the oldest families in the county. So that when I was doing the research on the events of 1912. You know, I recognized all the family names, and I knew I had gone to school and played baseball and stuff with a lot of their great-great-grandchildren. So we knew a lot of those people, and we never had any kind of direct threat. But, you know, when Oprah left in 87, after filming her episode, a reporter asked her what she'd found, and she said, "I found a lot of white people who are also very frightened here. You know, there's a lot of fear in this entire community." And I think she got that exactly right, because, you know, it was a... Some of this was enabled not just by the perpetrators of this violence, but also by a code of silence and intimidation that made it feel dangerous to even speak out against it.
But your parents didn't, there were no repercussions for them for being some of the few local residents who took part in that original march.
My mom, there was a trial where Morris Dees and the Southern Poverty Law Center sued the Klan for their role in the January 17th violence. And there was a lawsuit that was meant to really bankrupt the Klan. It was a civil suit for conspiracy to deprive of civil rights. And my mom was one of the witnesses at that trial talking about the attacks on January 17th. And, you know, she had some people approach her in the lobby of, you know, of the courtroom and really make it clear that she was taking a risk by talking. But this was sort of whispered, and people trying to communicate that as quietly as they could. But, you know, my parents are both from Birmingham. They grew up in 1950s Birmingham. So they grew up in the Birmingham of Bull Connor and George Wallace. And it meant that this kind of thing wasn't all that new to them. They had seen folks like this before.
Wow. So we were talking earlier about whether or not you're going to do a book event in Cumming, Georgia, in Forsyth County. What are your thoughts? And, you know, what has the reaction been to the book from people there?
You know, I would totally go back to Forsyth and talk to people. I've heard from a lot of folks who are very, you know, I know there are people who are probably not happy. And I when the Atlanta Journal-Constitution posted an excerpt from the book, I made the mistake of scrolling down to the comments section, you know, and it was clear from that some of the old, you know, anger about talking about this stuff is still present. And there were people from Forsyth who talked about me dredging up, you know, old news and old things, and who said something I heard my whole life, which was, "This will never heal if you keep talking about it." You know, and I think this is a kind of wishful thinking that that goes all the way back to 1912. In 1912, the newspapers, a constant refrain is, "No more trouble at Cumming, all quiet," right? "No further trouble expected." I can't tell you how many articles I found that end that way. And it's this on the part of a lot of white observers who aren't participating in this kind of violence. There is a desire to just leave it alone and maybe it will heal. So I know those folks are there. There are also a lot of people who I've talked to who are grateful. And I know the county has changed. You know, there's an African-American man named Daniel Blackman is running for state senate from Forsyth. And when I learned this a couple of months ago, you know, I was astonished that, you know, there's a black man on the ballot to represent Forsyth County in the Georgia State Senate. And, you know, I'm really rooting for him to win on November 8th because, you know, someone in a position of leadership in Forsyth like Daniel Blackman could really end all of this denial, turn and face this.
Right.
You know, on the Cumming Square right now, there's a statue of a guy named Hiram Parks Bell, who was an unrepentant white supremacist who was part of the Democratic bloc that helped expel all of the elected black leaders in the 1870s. And there's a really, like, you know, there's a larger than life statue of this guy on the same square where Rob Edwards was lynched. And there's no sign at all of any of the rest of this. So, you know, the notion that the county might turn and face all of this is something that I'm hopeful for.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious about your research, about contacting the descendants. Tell me about that. And you told a particularly interesting story of trying to track down the woman who had initially been, Ms. Daniels, who had initially been indicted or whatever, and then trying to track her. She just disappeared, but then you were able to track her.
Yeah, Jane Daniel was the sister, and she, you know, it's a really tragic story. Jane Daniel was 21. Her husband was Rob Edwards, so she was the widow of the guy who was lynched. Her brother and her cousin were also hung in what really amounts to a legal lynching. And yeah, I lost Jane's trail. She moved to Gainesville, and then she just disappeared from all of the archives. And eventually, I kept seeing in, I used Ancestry.com a lot to find some of this work is very about very old events. And yet some of my research was really enabled by a lot of high tech things that have gone online in the last decade. I think if I'd been trying to write this book 20 years ago, I would have found less. So I managed to track down Jane Daniels' niece, who is still alive at 82 and was in a nursing home in Gainesville. And she told me all about how Jane had gone to Detroit. And her niece was born in the 30s. So all of these events were long before she was born. But nonetheless, she helped me figure out where Jane was. And it was also, you know, that it was kind of astonishing to talk to someone this close in the family tree to all of these events.
So what's the lesson that you want people to take from this book?
I think one of the takeaway, you know, this is the question that I'm asked a lot, and I think only a fool would suggest that I figured out the problem of race in America, you know. I don't know what the answer is to that. I think I've tried to add one small piece to the puzzle by doing a real 200-year core sample in the history of one place. And what I think what I take back from it is that this dream that if you stop talking about this stuff, it will go away, is a dangerous idea, and it's a reckless idea. And so, you know, I thought a lot when I was doing the work on the book of the Truth and Reconciliation hearings in South Africa.
I was just, that exact image came to my head as you were talking.
Yeah, and so, you know, in answer to that question, I don't know how to get to reconciliation, but I know that Mandela was right. It goes through the truth. And I think a lot of people in my home place have wanted the reconciliation and wanted the forgiveness without paying the real cost. And the cost is you have to go through it. You have to testify. You have to turn and face it. And that's what I tried to do in the book. I don't know how to reconcile, but I thought I could provide one small piece of the truth.
Well, Patrick Phillips, thank you so much. The book is Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America.